Welcome to episode 20 of BioRossi's Few and Far Between, conversations on the cutting edge of clinical research. I'm your host, Chris O'Brien, CEO of BioRossi. Our guest for this episode is physician, author, and innovator, Dr. Bertil E. Lindmark. Bertil is the chief medical officer at Galecto, a biotech company focused on the development of novel small molecule therapeutics for the treatment of fibrosis, inflammation, and cancer. He's also the author of The Amazing Biological Revolution and The Amazing New Healthcare, a treatise and guide for living life without the specter of disease. We'll be discussing important trends in life sciences and technological discoveries that are top of mind among today's population, from counteracting premature aging to the automation of life-saving clinical research and fast diagnostics. Join us as Bertil gives us a guided tour of the current revolution occurring in biology and a glimpse of what the next 100 years has in store for healthcare and clinical research. This was a fun one. I hope you enjoy it. It is a pleasure to welcome Bertil Lindmark to the Few and Far Between podcast. Bertil, great to see you and speak with you.
Great to see you, Chris, and fantastic to be here.
So Bertil is a medic and a drug developer. He is currently the chief medical officer at Galecto. We're going to talk a little bit about that. He's also an author, and we're hoping for a little bit of a tour through the revolution that's happening in biology these days. I'm excited about all this. Okay, Bertil, let's start with a little bit about your background and journey. How did you get involved in biology and medicine? How did you end up in this world?
It was actually an aunt that gave me a book about the human body, life book, you know, with big pictures. And it looked kind of interesting. And that plus the fact that I broke my arm when I was 2 years old, I think sort of made me interested in what are these guys doing, the white coats and so on and so forth. So I think that was the beginning. But then I actually sort of started med school, and that turned into deeper interest in biology and obviously trying to do something more than just taking care of singular patients and trying to do something more for a wider set of patients in the industry.
That led you to work for biotech and start into that world. Is that right?
Yeah, I did like 10 years of clinical medicine, gastroenterology, and internal medicine, and a PhD thesis. I worked with one of the guys that found something that is called alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, which was probably the first genetically inherited disease that was really well mapped. And that turned into a sort of interest in trying to develop drugs and understanding immunology and inflammation. So I started in Astra too many years back and stayed there for 19 years, sort of taking on some interesting roles in respiratory and immunology.
That's fantastic. In fact, I'd love to get to the difference between small and large life sciences companies in a little bit. I'm going to go straight to the meat of the matter here. What caused me to ask you to join us today is your book, The Amazing Biological Revolution and The Amazing New Healthcare. And part of what excited me about this chat is increasingly we live in an era of specialization where people, particularly in life sciences, tend to go very deep into one relatively narrow subject matter. And this is a book really aimed at educating the general populace, I think, on what's happening in life sciences. Is that right? And talk a little bit, if you would, about what brought you here.
Yeah, I started thinking about, if you think back 100 years to 1922, that was the year my father was born. Obviously, NMDA ecstasy had already been invented by Hoechst chemists, but we didn't know anything about antibiotics, and we didn't know much about biology more than cells existed and a little bit about bacteria, but we didn't know about viruses and the deeper biology that we now sort of read about every day, basically. So I started thinking about sort of what has happened. The drug industry emanated from the chemistry that was needed to dye cloth in the manufacturing of cloth. And it actually turned into something that we have real use for with so many new medicines and so many new classes of medicines. It used to be just small molecules, but then peptides came and then large molecules, monoclonal antibodies and so on. And it's not stopping, you know, it is really manifesting on all fronts, both in terms of understanding biology deeply, being able to bring forward new molecules and turn these into new classes of medicines. And, you know, it's just the beginning. And you just want to extrapolate and see where is this going to bring us? Because in the end, on the one hand, it could be like an interesting game for intellectually prone people where you find new interesting stuff. But on the other hand, it is actually supposed to help mankind. And it's supposed to help mankind on a broader scale than just maybe a disease that would afflict 300 people in the world. I think we as a species want to actually live healthy lives, and we want to be able to avoid sort of catastrophic diseases like myocardial infarction or stroke or cancer and so on. In the end, we want to die. But I would like to postpone that. I would like to live my years healthily, and I'd like the medicines that we've come up with to help me do that.
Do you see, Berto, over the next 20 years or so, do you see extension of human life from some of these technologies on average, or do you see it more as improvement of quality of life? Where do you think we're headed?
I'm personally not too much in favor of extending human life, because I think we do have a kind of life cycle. We grow and we bloom, and then there is some kind of evolution and eventually death. And I think the maths and the economy of having people living 200 years, that becomes really, really difficult. You know, in the past, the retirement schemes in Europe used to be scheduled so that you would work until 65 and you would die before 75. Now you die at 85. And, you know, so who pays for those 10 extra years? And who pays for 30 extra years? I think you need to have a limited ambition when it comes to prolonging life. But I'm certainly for avoiding catastrophic events that thwart families and sort of makes people's lives difficult during the productive and post-productive years.
And so I very much hear that the societal impact of people routinely living past 100 is certainly something we don't, probably beyond the scope of this particular episode, but certainly something we don't have answers to. When you look forward, though, do you think things will look different 10, 15 years from now in terms of those last years of life? And I'll say my mother died recently, you know, of cancer, lung cancer that metastasized. It was a very painful last year of life for her, as it is for many people. The sort of final year is a really rough one. What do you think that will look like 10 or 15 years from now? Or do you think it will largely be the same?
I think it will largely be the same. I think we have different speeds. You have the evolution of the technologies and the understanding of biology. That is one speed, which seems to go fairly quick nowadays, kind of step change all the time. But then you have the speed of understanding therapeutic intervention. That's another speed. And then you have the slow speed, really slow speed, is clinical development. Because in the end, the clinical development code, as you know, you have to have the patients coming into your trials, and you have to treat 6-month therapies like 6-month therapy. You can't make it in 3 months. And so I think the rate limiting step is the step that's going to keep us away from new and novel fantastic therapies. That's going to keep going for a long period of time. So revolutionizing sort of human life, no, it will be a slow slog. But I think we can see that so many things are happening that transform many therapies in certain situations. So I think over time, we will be looking at lives where you reduce the risk of catastrophic life events and where you can probably think that you can live a healthy, productive life without having to worry about catastrophic medical events.
That's a very exciting possibility. We're in a sort of maybe the beginning of the steep part of the curve on improvement in life sciences as all of these technologies and new modalities come to bear. What do you think are the biggest misconceptions that lay people have about biology and bioscience?
You read so many lay articles about now they've found this or that, and it sounds like they've cured cancer sort of morning, noon, and night. And, you know, metastatic cancer is really, really a tricky problem. The leap from reading an article to actually believing something really important, revolutionary, would happen. That may be one of the fallacies of reading lay literature. And I think we all want to have that kind of a hope, pretend that something is going to happen really, really quick.
It sounds like you're saying, while there is incredible innovation happening, there's a tendency to make that sound like it's going to impact people's lives more quickly than is actually possible. Is that right?
I think that's true.
Well, with that important caveat established, what innovations are you most excited about right now? What are the fields that you think show the most promise? And I should add, one of the reasons that I was excited about this again is that I think you tend to cast a broad glance across the landscape of development right now. So what do you think?
If you look at the immunology, you know, the whole COVID thing, you look at the human troops, the human scientific troops moving towards understanding this disease. And I think that was fantastic to see, both in terms of therapeutics, in terms of minute understanding of what goes on, where's the spike protein, where does it attach to, what kind of primary and secondary effect could you see, et cetera. And understanding immunology is then something that has escalated during this time period so much compared to the previous many years. And I think we'll see the benefit. So COVID-19 was a devastating experience for many people and for mankind. But there is a positive aftermath where we actually will learn a number of things. And we'll also potentially, if we are smart human beings, we'll learn how to avoid these grand pandemics. They will come, but we need to understand we could have met this one in a different way and hopefully not politicize it as much as we potentially did.
When you think about collaboration, especially around vaccine development, but I guess for therapeutics as well in the pandemic, what grade do you give the world on that? How did we do collectively on collaboration?
If you look at the different countries per se, there was decent collaboration there. And we had so much people wanting to have this ambition to be healing humanity very quickly that they forgot a couple of different small steps and sort of the relationship to reality that became sacrificed. And that's a big learning, I think, for the future. If we have a naive picture of science being unbiased and very truthful, I think that it took a little bit of a dent.
Let's talk about, there is some innovation at least around sharing of information. And I guess we touched a little bit then there on mRNA. What are some of the other areas that you think we should be excited about?
We can see developments in all therapeutic classes, basically. And you have the addition of artificial intelligence and kind of automated processes, I think is another area that sort of is helping the industry to move quicker and faster and with higher precision. One of the technologies, and this is well known for everyone, that is CRISPR and the way that you can sort of sharply mutate a number of things and you can sort of make things happen with a completely different time frame compared to previously. So understanding of the core driving elements in a disease become clearer, faster, and therefore also the potential interventions that you could do against these different diseases. I'm hoping that this in the next 5-10 years will sort of revolutionize the understanding. I mean, where are the key points, the target points, where you have a number of bad events coalescing and turning into a vicious circle disease process? So these nodes of poorly functioning biology would be identified much quicker.
So we've seen CRISPR, Jennifer Doudna, win the Nobel Prize. We've seen a great deal of focus and investment moving into that space. It's certainly incredibly exciting. Are there areas that you think are underrated, underhyped, that are not getting the kind of focus that they deserve in terms of either their potential or the actual reality of what teams are doing today?
Yeah, one of the areas that I became interested in when I was working at Eterna Immunotherapies in Belgium is the subject of long non-coding RNA. This is like 60% of all RNA. It's actually not non-coding. It's actually coding. 10% of the long non-coding RNA is coding. And those codes are becoming interesting, especially in cancer disease, where the expression of proteins that are abnormal kind of can become the targets for vaccines and therapeutic interventions. So I think that's still in its early days when it comes to understanding and potential therapeutic use.
Exciting, and I agree, not something that we hear quite as much of a focus on. Another thing you talk about in the book are fast diagnostics. Will you tell us a little bit about what's going on there and what you think is interesting?
Yeah, I was starting to think about if you ever go to a physician, it could take you quite some time for the medic to understand. A, they don't understand what you say. B, they don't understand what kind of disease it is. C, they take some tests. And then potentially they may or may not understand what this is all about. The precision in the diagnosis is not super good, to be honest. But at the same time, you can see that the evolution of, for example, circulating tumor DNA circulates tumor cells. This is something that is becoming much sharper over time. A company that I was working with, they claimed to be able to find minute amounts of circulating tumor DNA and actually basically do a liquid biopsy of your tumor understanding which are the tumor drivers and so on and so forth. If you think about the blood, it is really like a pea soup, but the pea soup are the peas are the red erythrocytes, and then you have proteins and you have nutrients and you have fats. And it's just remarkable that anyone can find anything in blood. But, you know, you can find minute amounts of many, many things. And this sort of, and it becomes cheaper and it becomes faster. And I was thinking, well, if everyone becomes sick, I'd like a one day diagnosis and the next day therapy and the third day cure. Basically, if you knew what you were doing, you would be able to find my disease in really short period of time. And you would be able to pinpoint exactly what's wrong and turn that right. We are certainly not at that stage in human medicine, but I think that's an aspiration. It sounds absurd, but, you know, as Einstein said, if you don't ask for the absurd, you're not innovative.
That's fantastic. I think that's right. And certainly some of the medicines we use today routinely would have seemed absurd a generation ago.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Are there other areas that you think are exciting and interesting right now? So we've talked a little bit about AI systems and CRISPR, about diagnostics. What else?
So I spoke about that before. We were born, we kind of bloom, and we then mature, and then we age a bit. But, you know, aging is something that is different between different people, but also the aging of different organs. So you can see people that have the heart of a 70-year-old already when they're 35. And, you know, same with the lungs, the same with the liver, the kidney, and even with your brains. So understanding aging and actually counteracting aging, that is one of the key areas to help people live really healthy lives. And then, and you know, there is a lot of work going on because people are excited by the prospect of actually identifying premature aging, but also counteracting this. And the combination of inflammation, microthrombosis, and fibrosis is one of the themes that you would see in aging organs. And so in order to intervene, you need to understand these processes and in a simple way sort of counteract them. So the coagulation system is one of these things that sort of, together with inflammation and fibrosis, go wrong when we age. And different organs will have different propensity for getting clogged up and senescent cells and immune senescence, etc. So that whole understanding is exciting and something that we can hope to help our lives go forward.
That's great. I want to flip to human life expectancy for a minute. And one of the things that you write about and you've talked about is access to quality healthcare and quality of healthcare around the world. Will you talk a little bit about that? Where do you see that going? Do you see a world of haves and have-nots as a permanent state for humanity, or are you more hopeful?
It's going on several different levels. On the one hand, sort of diagnosis and access to basic medicines probably is improving. And if you look at the percentage of poor people, which is one of the biggest arbiters of poor health, that is reducing dramatically. And, you know, like in the 60s to now, going from maybe 60% poor people in the world to 20% or something like that. That is a revolution in itself. I'm not sure why it happened, but it looks like sort of international trade and economy and so on. So that's one thing. On the other hand, you have over medication in certain parts of the world and under medication. You know, the belief that the doctor could actually help us is a bit exaggerated. You need to take care of your own health first and eat and move your body and avoid drinking, smoking, and getting too fat. Those are simple things, but very difficult for people because, you know, we have the trends of access to calories and these sedentarism and access to car transport and everything. There is so much working against us keeping healthy and fit. So we need to be conscious and we need to understand this, each and every one. And if we think that physicians are going to help us at the end, that is a bit of a fallacy, I think.
Yeah, all right. I love this point of each of us being responsible for our own health. That makes a lot of sense. When you look at healthcare systems around the world, are there ones that stand out to you as particularly effective at emphasizing the kinds of things you just talked about?
I wouldn't be an expert in healthcare systems, but you know, you look at what Europe is spending, 8.9% of gross national product. US is spending, I think, 18.9%. if you look at the number of variables like life expectancy, like cancer therapy results, etc., there is no big difference. So you can organize healthcare in many different ways, but still, I think we are sort of generally speaking fairly disorganized because everything is based on what kind of catastrophic surgery. So if something bad happens, you go to a doctor, he or she makes you survive. And, you know, myocardial infarction, stroke, metastatic cancer, all these bad things have to happen first. And then you try to save what's left. It would be much smarter to have a very sensitive system to identify people really at risk and to preempt and prevent the risk. That would be a smarter way to spend your healthcare money, especially if you when so many more people are becoming so old and actually need much more care at the end of the life.
So, okay, I'm going to switch from the macro health systems to the micro. We have a child who's finishing university with a biology degree. What advice would you give to a young person who's about to start their career in the life sciences?
I think if you're really, really interested in biology and sort of want to go deep, then of course you need to continue on that path. But at the same time, a degree in biology can lead you to so many different career paths. I think it's on the one hand, it's a way to qualify and to help people understand that you actually can read and learn something. And you can go into commercial, you can go into science. I think you need to understand after that kind of a degree, you need to know where is your heart really in hardcore biology. Okay, let's go then. But if you're not sure about that, then this is a stepping stone to finding out what is your real passion. Because, you know, if you're working according to your passion, then you don't have to work. Every day is just a fantastic experience.
That's lovely. That's lovely. I will certainly share that. All right. One more area I'd like you to spend a minute or two on. So you've worked in very large pharma organizations. You've worked in small startups. There's obviously a huge shift in innovation towards smaller organizations. Will you talk a little bit about that? Why you think that maybe that's true? What makes smaller organizations effective if you think they are? You know, let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. When I started at Astra, I was thinking the R&D organization was the core and you had a small commercial organization. After a while, I realized that this is big pharma is really commercial organizations and the R&D part is really not the main feature. And you look at the internal R&D and the likelihood of success versus buying a half ready compound from outside. I think many big pharma companies are actually much better at buying good compounds than actually making them. At the same time, they need to have good internal R&D. But the way that big pharma sort of are organizing R&D is a bit taking the fun out of R&D because it becomes a bit too regimented. And, you know, when you have to follow the science and you have to look for the opportunity. And obviously with small companies, you would have one good thing, one bad thing, basically tend to follow the science. But you also probably keep stuff alive longer than you actually need. And you can talk about zombie projects that, sort of, yeah, let's continue now. Everyone sees it's a dead parrot or a dead horse, but it's kept alive. But the small companies, I mean, the way that you interact, the way that people can play a meaningful role is much, much bigger in small companies. At least for me, I liked a lot being in Astra and AstraZeneca, and I like to be head of R&D at Amaro. But, you know, going to small companies and actually designing trials and making sure the study happens and reading the results much closer to the action is much more interesting and rewarding.
That's great. If you were running AstraZeneca today or some other large global pharma organization and you weren't burdened with the legacy expenses of challenges of the past, so we're living in the land of fantasy for a second, how would you build that company now? Would it do any original research itself or would it primarily be developing, doing corp dev, buying interesting drugs, whether, you know, in the preclinical or clinical stage and then commercializing them?
I would say do both, but I would probably do like a much bigger seed kind of expenditure and being much more agile when it comes to investing in early startups and supporting them, because big pharma with the muscles of big pharma can make things happen pretty quick. And if you're agile in that whole sector, then of course you can both understand which are the duds and which are the ones that seem to have some legs and some vitamins, and then making sure that they fail fast and cheaply, that they actually become real successes. Many of the biotech companies take longer time and burn more money because they don't have the right power to make things happen quickly. Big pharma can, if applied the big pharma forces in the right way, that could be very, that kind of marriage could be extremely powerful and both be helpful to the small company and to the big company.
Yeah, one of the things we see now is smaller companies raising a lot of money so that they're able to stay in the game into commercialization. And I think one of the questions is whether that's a good thing. I definitely agree with you that in terms of creativity and shepherding drugs through the clinical process and through the regulatory process, smaller companies are doing amazing things these days. What do you think about commercialization?
I would intuitively try to stay away from commercialization because, you know, that animal is completely different compared to an R&D organization. Small organizations can do interesting science and phase two, sometimes small phase three. But, you know, to prepare a drug launch and to actually run commercial apparatus, I haven't seen too many companies that actually make this. I think this is higher likelihood that you actually fail. Then you will fail both in your R&D part and in your commercial part, because the commercial part assumes so much of your energy that you kind of fail in the R&D part. And then you fail in the commercial part. So no, I would not advise that you take care of your own babies. Put them in a good school.
I like that. Yeah. Put them into good hands and let someone else who is expert at that figure out how to bring them to patients.
Yeah, that is much more beneficial for yourself and your night's sleep and even for the big organization.
Last question from me. The biotech and small pharma world in Europe over the last decade or so, you've seen some real change, including you've gone from larger organizations to smaller ones. What do you think is happening there? And would you talk a little bit about how vibrant or non-vibrant you think the small company scene is in Europe these days?
I think you've seen an uptick both in Europe and in the US, but it's pretty clear that the US is leading in terms of funding and in terms of efficient sort of movement of resources to the right companies. So I think both in terms of sort of making sure that the biotech companies get a heap of money, they do their best, and then they fail or succeed. That's good. Europe is funding at a low level, and therefore the companies go slower, and they fail because they go slow. So you need speed over ground, and you need to have that kind of infusion of talent, infusion of ideas, and infusion of capital in order to make the industry really successful. And I think many European companies have good ideas, but if it takes like 5 years to make them happen, then the world has changed. And that is really a trick that I think the American biotech industry has learned. Move quickly, efficiently, and then either fail or go to the next stage. Europe is falling behind, but at a slower pace and at a lower level. And I see that as a division between these two territories.
Interesting. I would have thought that European companies were seeing some progress on that front. There are more interesting smaller biotechs in Europe now than there were a decade ago. Is that true? How do you think about that?
Yeah, that is certainly true. I think you're absolutely right, Chris. But you can see it's sort of, we're still on some kind of path of expanding and turning this into a much more dynamic, I would say, the American biotech industry. And you can see I saw some McKinsey data, the European investment, the average European investment was about like 50% of the American investment. On the one hand, if you have less money, you need to think more carefully, and that could be a kind of aberration of riches if you have a bit too good funding. At the same time, good funds help you move quick.
Yeah, it's a balance. I had dinner with a biotech CEO, American biotech CEO last night, actually a European who lives in the US now, who was complaining about the amount of funding that is available and some companies that have probably been overfunded. So that can be a challenge, of course, as well. But as you say, incredibly talented people with innovative ideas and access to capital is a magic formula that's generated some extraordinary breakthroughs.
Yeah, absolutely. You're not supposed to start talking about building your headquarters on day one. It's sort of a 25-story glass window. No, it's not okay.
That's exactly right. All right. Well, no 25 story towers here. Bertil, it is as always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for the book, which helped me to put into perspective the different categories and areas that we have to be thinking about as we think about this revolution, the early stage of which we are in. It's going to be exciting to see what the next few years bring.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
Wonderful. Thanks, Bertil.
Thank you for listening to the latest episode of Few and Far Between. If you enjoyed this podcast or have suggestions for future episodes, please get in touch with us. You can email us at fewandfarbetween@biorossi.com or contact us on our website at biorossi.com. You can also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. They really help. See you next time.